good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for a few minutes until we ask for them. We have with us Mr. Powers and Mr. Bill Powers, and we're going to be talking about oil, about energy. Bill is one of the nation's leading experts on this. What's really happening to oil prices, energy prices? What's going on over in the Middle East? How will that impact on oil prices? What happens if the House of Saud really falls, or as the terrorism increases over in Saudi Arabia and begins to disrupt oil flows? There are lots of unanswered questions. So with that just as an opening, now let's hear what Bill has to say. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
It's great to be here, Dr. Stan.
Well, why don't you just tell our listeners who really don't know too much about you, just a little bit about yourself and your background and how you got so interested in the oil, availability of oil prices, etc.
Okay. I write a newsletter called the Canadian Energy Viewpoint. It's the only newsletter that's published in the United States that focuses exclusively on investment in the Canadian energy sector. I really formed a great deal of interest in the energy sector in Canada about 5 or 6 years ago when oil and gas were really out of favor as far as the investment community goes, and I felt that the world has a finite amount of oil and gas and that we continue to deplete those resources at an accelerating rate, and that the future was going to be a lot brighter than the past 20 years have been for the oil and gas industry, and I thought it was a great place to invest. And my newsletter grew out of an interest in, for my own investment purposes.
All right, fine. So what do you see happening right now? Of course, we find America over there in the Middle East. That's where really, as far as we know, the great last great supplies of oil are there in the basin in the various countries over there surrounding the Caspian Sea, certainly in Iraq. I think Iraq, what is the second largest oil supplies in the world?
As of right now, Iraq it's very difficult to understand exactly how much oil they have. A big deal of what's going on in the Middle East is has to do with a struggle for control over the resources. And Saudi Arabia has the world's largest endowment of oil. That is pretty much. It's been well defined and it's been well understood for a number of years. They also are the largest producer of oil and exporter of oil in the world. However, what's going on there is, from a political standpoint, is quite different from Iraq in the sense that there is a royal family that rules Saudi Arabia, and they are having an extremely difficult time maintaining control over that country for a wide variety of reasons. Whereas Iraq right now, as the U.S. continues to become deeper and deeper involved over there, it's becoming very unclear exactly how much oil they have, how quickly it could be brought on production, and more importantly, what the investment would be to further exploit Iraq's resources. So you have two very troubled situations over in the Middle East with two of the countries that have by far the world's largest endowment of oil, and it's I think they're both going to be faced with supply disruptions in the near future.
All right, hang on to that thought here for just a moment. Well, our guest this evening, Bill Powers, we're talking about what's really going on. As far as the availability of oil is concerned, we've seen the rise in the prices at the pumps. We're told now that the price is going to be coming down maybe before the election. It would appear that some sort of arrangement has been made. Bob Woodward talked about this in his book, on the Bush administration plan of attack, and he said that he'd talked to key people in the oil industry who said that George Bush had asked for and had been guaranteed that the oil cartel would get the price of oil down before the election. So do you think that's a factor at all?
I think Bob Woodward is very mistaken in that. I think that he clearly has not done a very in-depth study of the availability of excess production capacity of what's available in Saudi Arabia or anywhere else in the world. Right now, the OPEC member countries are producing full out, and that includes Saudi Arabia.
Well, they've just said that they were going to increase production 2 to 2.5 million barrels next month. Is that just talk, or is that...
If you read real closely to what they say, they are increasing the quota by 2 million barrels. And they are currently producing above quota, so it's just the legitimization of their existing production. So right now, they are at maximum capacity, and I think that there's a much better book that people should go out and read that talks about what's going on in Saudi Arabia. It's a book by Robert Baer, who's a former CIA agent, called Sleeping with the Devil. He talks a great deal about oil and the royal family and in Saudi Arabia, and what's likely to occur in the near future in Saudi Arabia. And it doesn't include them increasing supply to bring the price down.
Okay, fine. So then right now, why you feel that the oil is being produced at its maximum level? Of course, my concern is that if the terrorists were to strike any of those oil-producing facilities or, you know, the areas offshore there, they could really disrupt the oil production and the availability of oil, couldn't they?
Yes, absolutely. Robert Baer makes very clear in his book, there's several choke points in Saudi Arabia that they have the biggest export terminal in the world there. They have some of the biggest pipelines in the world that are exposed for miles and miles. One of the things that makes, and they also are very heavily guarded. But from what we're seeing in the past, the terrorist attacks in Saudi Arabia, they're much more interested, I believe, in keeping the oil industry intact. And the attacks have been more against personnel. So far, we've seen it mostly targeting Western personnel involved in the oil industry. And I think that is the militants over there are interested in not disrupting supply, but simply taking control. And I think that what I see unfolding in Saudi Arabia is that the oil infrastructure stays pretty much intact, but a change of control takes place, and that would be simply removing the royal family eventually.
Well, of course, if they were removed, then the oil would fall into the hands of the radical Islamic group and, working along with the Wahhabi clerics. And that certainly would be, I think, very, very bad for the United States. These people, I'm sure, could sell their oil to China, which is taking more and more oil. Its oil appetite is expanding all the time. I would think that this would be make it very difficult for us if they control the oil there.
Yes, absolutely. They're not going to be selling it for $35 or even $45. It's probably north of $100. How quickly that takes place, time will tell, but one thing that's guaranteed when the House of Saud falls is prices are going to probably double from here.
Well, of course, you don't say if the House of Saud falls. You say when the House of Saud falls. Are you fairly certain it's going to be disrupted and fall in the near future?
Well, if history is any guide, there's been very few instances throughout history where so few have stolen from so many for so long. If you go back in throughout the history of Saudi Arabia, it's not really much of a country in the sense that when the Ottoman Empire was carved up after World War One, none of these countries, Saudi Arabia really has no natural boundaries or it's simply made up of a bunch of nomadic tribes where they eventually became a country. And what oil has really changed that society and has changed that culture. And right now we are seeing a relatively small group of people that are extremely rich and have I would say commandeered the resources of a booming population. Right now, Saudi Arabia has over 22 million residents, and this is more than double from just the figure in 1980. And what we're seeing is the per capita income in Saudi Arabia is now only about $4,000. And
it's really fallen dramatically over the last few years, hasn't
it? It's fallen dramatically since 1980. In 1980, it was about $28,000 a year. And right now, with the increase in the population, the country almost went bankrupt. It had an extraordinary amount of debt in recent years. I mean, the country had a huge surplus in the early 80s, and now it runs a huge deficit, or it's had a huge deficit, and last year was the first year in about five where they didn't run an enormous deficit, a lot of debt in Saudi Arabia. So one of the things that, in a tremendous amount of corruption. So really, it's not a question of, and really, very few people in Saudi Arabia outside of, view the royal family as legitimate. So it's not a democracy by any means, and I just really doubt, and I'm almost certain that the country, the royal family, will be removed from control.
All right, the royal family is about, I think, what is it, about 5,000 people, something like that.
I believe it's even more than that now. I believe there's about 5,000 princes.
5,000 princes, and then their families. Right.
If you expand out from there, I think it's probably closer to 25,000 or 30,000 people.
But they, of course, run the country in a feudalistic system. It's a feudal monarchy, which we've been backing for many years. We're just horrified at the thought of what they did in Afghanistan to the people there. You know, they cut off their hands and feet and stoned people, you know, if they were caught in adultery. But that's exactly what they do in Saudi Arabia. If we were to see night after night after night how the people in Saudi Arabia are treated, why, they could do to the public's perception of Saudi Arabia exactly what they did to the public perception of Afghanistan, and justify perhaps even military intervention.
Yes, it's going to be a real ugly day if the U.S. were to get involved militarily in Saudi Arabia, but getting back to your point about lack of freedoms in Saudi Arabia, one of the most disturbing aspects in Robert Baer's book is the amount of beheadings, public beheadings in Saudi Arabia. And that is very disturbing. It's about over 1,000 every year.
And they have a square. They call it Chop Chop Square. They cut off
Correct. Hands,
they cut off feet, they cut off heads. A public display of this weekly, but you know, it's the most amazing thing. We almost never talk about that here in the United States, because they're the good monarch. They're the good people. It was the wicked people over there in Afghanistan who were doing the same thing that we went to war with.
Unfortunately, perception of Saudi Arabia is much different from reality.
Right. And, it's a brutal, feudal dictatorship. Well, let's get away from Saudi Arabia. Other than what do you think is going to happen to oil prices here, perhaps in the next several years?
Well, I mean, I recently, in February of this year, I wrote an article for my newsletter that called for get ready for $50 oil. In the newsletter that I believe the oil was going to $50 a barrel within the next 18 months. And the supply-demand fundamentals definitely support a $50 price. That's in the short term. I believe we will see $100 oil before the end of this decade.
$100 oil will certainly have an impact then on our economy.
To some degree, yes. One of the things that's very, very misunderstood by most is that high oil prices choke off economic growth. If we go back to 1984, which had the highest GDP growth, which is an election year for Ronald Reagan, the highest economic growth of any post-war year, and at 4.5%, and oil prices in 2003 dollars were between $55 and $65 a barrel throughout the entire year. So what we're seeing is, and if we go back even to third quarter of 2003, we had $27 oil and 8% GDP growth. There's high oil prices do not choke off GDP growth, and in fact, what we see is increased economic activity from oil exporting countries, in the sense that countries who export more will typically buy more from or have increased oil revenues. They will end up buying more from some of the more developed countries. So there are consumers in the developed oil importing countries who do suffer, but there are places elsewhere in the world that do quite well.
Well, if we were having $100 oil, wouldn't that get the price of a gallon of gasoline up to $4 or so?
If you put it in taxes, I don't even know whether you would need $100 oil to get the $4 gasoline. It depends what part of the country you live in. I think gasoline prices are heading in that direction.
All right, fine. Now, what about natural gas? Certainly, the government, in its wisdom, had insisted that all of the new electric generating plants here on the West Coast would have to use natural gas. And by so doing, of course, they created an artificial shortage of natural gas. It skyrocketed. Prices have doubled of natural gas. What's happening to natural gas supplies, and what will happen to the price of that, in your opinion?
I think you hit it right on the head. In 1999, the National Petroleum Council issued a research arm of the Department of Energy, came out with a study that said U.S. natural gas supplies would be plentiful for the next 50 years. They said that production would continue to increase at a pretty rapid rate, and that gas would remain cheap for the foreseeable future. And this was only published 5 years ago. And at that time, in 1999, there was a huge natural gas-powered power plant building boom. Since in the last 5 years, we've had 220,000 megawatts of gas-fired power plants come online, and there's a few more to be built within the next couple of years. But when we've seen electricity from natural gas-fired power plants increase to about 16 or 17% of total U.S. electricity production. So what we are seeing is that the National Petroleum Council's predictions in 1999 were almost outrageously false, in the sense that they've been incredibly poor. Gas has gone from about $2 per thousand cubic feet to $6.50 per thousand cubic feet. U.S. production fell in 2003. It's going to fall this year, and it will probably fall next year. And very likely that this pattern is going to continue.
Well, of course, that what you're talking about is over tripling of the price of natural gas, which is certainly, I would feel, quite a highly inflationary issue. And then, of course, when we get back, we'll want to be talking about why the production is falling. Is it that we're running out of natural gas? Is it they won't let them drill any new wells? Is it that they won't let us bring the natural gas down from Alaska, which could certainly be brought here to this country? We'll be back in just a moment or two. And, of course, we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest is Bill Powers. We're talking about the problems that we have in energy. And, of course, the question I broached just before we went to the break was, what's going to happen here? Now, why do we have these shortages of natural gas? Why is the production falling? Are the wells running dry, or is it because we're not allowed to drill any new wells? Are we running out of natural gas? What's really the issue here?
Really, for the last several years, we've been on a production treadmill. And what we're finding is that the new discoveries for natural gas basins are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. The reserves per well are going down. Production per well is going down. So even though we are seeing increased drilling activity, and in Canada we had a record drilling year last year, production falls. And it's simply what is now what we've seen in the oil world, it's Hubbert's Peak, which is, for listeners who may not be familiar with this, it was just a quick little history. It's in 1956, a researcher came up with a theory that oil production follows a bell-shaped curve, in the sense that it starts from zero. At once half the reserves have been depleted in a given region, it peaks, and then it declines along a bell-shaped curve. And I think we're seeing this with natural gas production in the United States. I believe we, right now, even if new areas were developed, there's so many areas that are now in irreversible declines due to just the natural life of the wells, that even if new areas were brought online, we would still can see production continue to fall. And this is, but more importantly, production is going to fall irrespective of price. So that is a very unique set of circumstances.
Well, what about the massive supplies of natural gas that they're pumping back into the ground up in Alaska, and they blocked at every turn efforts to build that pipeline down here? They should have done it 20 years ago to bring the natural gas off the North Slope down here. Instead, I think they have something like 75 747 engines just pumping the natural gas that's coming up back into the ground because they can't vent it.
There's one of the things about building up until relatively recently, there was what has been referred to as the natural gas bubble, in the sense that for about 13 years, their natural gas prices pretty much bounced between $1.25 and $2.50. So there really, it would have been very difficult to justify the economics of a pipeline up until recently. However, one of the things that needs to be understood for a lot of listeners is that the cost of the pipeline from the North Slope of Alaska to the existing pipeline infrastructure in Canada would be enormously expensive. And just to give you a couple quick numbers here, the pipeline that was built from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez was about $9 billion, and that went through just the state of Alaska, and it was only 800 miles. The pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to the west coast of the United States would be anywhere between 1,800 miles to 2,300 miles, depending on the route they choose. And the cost for this would be literally astronomical, well over $20 billion. And right now, and it would cover, go through several provinces in Canada.
Hold on. Okay, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Bill Powers, who writes a newsletter about what's happening to energy. And he's talking about the natural gas that's available up on the North Slope of Alaska. The original pipeline went about 800 miles it cost about $9 billion, and he's saying that if we were to bring it all the way down into the States, it would cost a pipeline from the North Slope to, say, the United States would have to go through several Canadian provinces, cost about $20 billion. But why couldn't it just be taken to a port, liquefied, and then brought down that way? It'd be a lot cheaper than building the pipeline all the way down.
Yes, I mean, that's a possibility, but one of the things that that there's a problem with that is there's already the United States already exports liquefied natural gas out of Kenai, Alaska, to Japan. So that is being done in Alaska as we speak, and it's been done since the late 70s. However, you also run into difficulties with building the LNG tanker ships as well as the regasification terminals, which do not exist today on the west coast of the United States, and the costs would be possibly about the same, if not more, to create LNG terminals up in Alaska. So it is a possibility, but one of the other things that is very important to recognize is that if you do remove the gas from the North Slope oil fields, those oil fields will cease production. And right now that's about 600,000 barrels a day. So that would be a substantial limit to, there is a substantial limit to what you could pull out of Alaska right now without disrupting the oil field.
Well, some people want to run the gas from the North Slope over into Canada and come down, and you're, because you already have pipelines somewhere in the not too far away from there, don't you?
Actually, it's still, the pipeline that Canada has proposed is a little shorter. It would be from the North Slope under the Beaufort Sea down the Mackenzie River Delta. Still an extremely expensive project, and it's still a long way off. So it's.
Well, but the thing is, if we don't start making our preparations now, why it's going to get more expensive, and you can't wait until you're in a crisis situation to begin thinking about something going to take you 10 years to build. Seems to me we should have started building this about 10 years ago.
We probably should have been given it a lot more thought, and possibly 10 years ago. But as of right now, these are very, very political projects. A lot of money is involved, and the progress is going to be slow. Canada's right now, I think, has a lot better proposal to go under the Beaufort Sea and down the Mackenzie Delta, has a much better chance of at least starting construction sooner than the proposal to go through the state of Alaska.
All right, fine. Now, we talk about oil. Apparently, Canada has very, very rich oil sands, which haven't been economically feasible to develop in the past. But now with gasoline pushing $50 a barrel, certainly there's a tremendous amount of oil that is recoverable through the oil sands in Canada, isn't there?
Yes, there's a great deal of oil. As far as the amount of actual reserves, it's deep into the billions of barrels. However, one of the things that should be noted about tar sands, which is heavy oil sands up in northern Alberta, is that it requires a lot of energy to take the tar sands and make them make it into synthetic crude oil. It's difficult to tell whether there will be enough natural gas in northern Canada to generate the electricity that will be needed to fire up the plants that will take the bitumen or the tar sands and make them into synthetic crude. So the projects right now are moving along very rapidly. I believe there's over 1 million barrels a day produced in northern Canada of synthetic crude, and this will go to over 2 million within the next 5 to 6 years. So this is a major growth area for Canada, and it is really important for North America's, domestic supply.
In fact, Canada is really a very wealthy country as far as natural elements, as far as natural resources, as far as oil, natural gas, many, many minerals that are up there, and certainly with a vast amount of land and a sparse population compared to the United States, why you as a Canadian are certainly very fortunate. We're going to be back here. Our guest is Bill Powers. He writes a newsletter, and when we get back, we're going to have Bill tell us and tell our listeners how to get this, who to call, and the website to go to. But it's important you understand that we've got real problems as far as energy is concerned, because energy, of course, is the foundation of our economic system. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Bill Powers. We're talking about things that are happening, and as far as natural gas, as far as oil, are there any other things as far as the energy situation that we should be talking about?
One of the things that I've been adding in my newsletter the last couple of months has been uranium, as far as I believe that we're on the verge of a big comeback in the nuclear power industry, not so much here in the United States right now, but in emerging countries such as India and China. They are very committed to the nuclear power industry, and I believe that the price of uranium is going to crawl out of a 15-year slump and do quite well over the coming couple of years.
Has it started up going up yet, or is it?
Yes, it just hit a 10-year high today, or actually earlier this week, and it's been about $17.85 a pound for uranium, which is much higher than it's been in over a decade. And I think it's just the beginning of what's to come. It's about the world's most unbalanced commodity market right now.
Well, now, of course, how high do you think the price of uranium could actually go?
I'd say well over, I mean, many times where it is right now. One of the things that's difficult about the uranium market is there's several distorting forces. One of them is the U.S. enrichment corporations dumping of about 6 million pounds of uranium on the market a year that they receive. It's a stockpile that they received free from the U.S. government when they became a private entity in 1998 after being part of the U.S. Department of Energy for a number of years. And they have about three more years to sell about 6 million pounds into a world market of about 172 million pounds that's consumed every year. So if they're selling, you know, over 3% of the world consumption, this can have distorting forces. It's also going to be difficult to tell how much uranium is going to come out of Russia and the former Soviet Union. So there's some above-ground stocks that need to be worked off, and they are. But I believe in the next 3 to 4 years, we will see uranium prices much higher than they are right now.
Now, right. And of course, it's amazing that everybody else in the world can have nuclear energy. We can't have it here in the United States because we don't know what to do with the spent rods, but everybody else in the world knows what to do with the spent rods. If there was ever an example of how you can scam a nation, it is what you do with the nuclear fuel and after it's spent. And I will tell you what everybody else does. They reprocess it. Why don't we do it here in America? Because they won't let us. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Bill Powers, and we're talking about energy, and when we get back, we're going to talk more about uranium and how the market seems to be expanding. As countries throughout the world are turning to nuclear power, of course, we develop nuclear power, and we're not allowed to develop it here or utilize it in the United States because of all the rules and regulations that have been put in. And although they talk about safety, they talk about concern, they talk about, oh, what are we going to do with the spent fuel? But it really is all about, they have wanted us to do this because they wanted us to be using oil and natural gas and driving the price up. Well, Bill, let's go ahead and get your address and website in case any of our listeners would like to get your information.
Yes, you can go to find out more about my newsletter. It's you can go out to www.CanadianEnergyViewpoint.com. It's an investment newsletter covering the oil and gas sector. It's $199 a year, and I publish 12 monthly issues as well as mid-month updates.
All right, fine. And so if you want to be right on top of what's happening in the energy market, why, I've heard some very, very good things about Mr. Powers and the information he has. Now, while we were at our break, we were talking about uranium and Bill thinks that the uranium market is going to come back and come back very strongly, not necessarily because the United States is going to go into nuclear energy development at this time, although in my opinion we should have done it long ago, and of course everybody says, nuclear energy is so expensive. No, it's not expensive. The only reason it's expensive is because the environmentalists who are subsidized by our great corporations sometimes even by our great oil corporations. Gee, I wonder why they're trying to discourage nuclear energy, or maybe they're buying up the uranium right now, and it's gone from weak hands to small hands. Well, anyway, or it's to strong hands. Under any circumstances, apparently the uranium market is beginning to look fairly good, and Bill was commenting that the uranium price just hit a new high. What was it, this last week or so?
Yes, it was $17.85 a pound. One of the things that, you know, I really want to stress is that, you know, the United States has there's 103 nuclear reactors, and then we produce about 20% of our electricity from nuclear reactors right now. There has been a reactor that's come online since 1993, and there's about 440 in the world right now. One of the things that's very interesting is that China and India are both very committed to the nuclear power for their electricity needs in the future. And India right now is building 8 nuclear plants over there, and I think it's very telling as far as their comfort level with a very low cost of electricity, and actually, for a source of electricity that has no carbon emissions. So unlike coal and unlike natural gas and oil-fired power plants, nuclear plants just emit steam. So it's actually a very interesting take on how their economy is going to grow, because electricity is always increased demand for electricity is always present in a growing economy.
Well, if you wanted to destroy our economy, you would pass the Kyoto Protocol, demand that we cut back on greenhouse emissions 30% to 40%, block our ability to build nuclear power plants, and you would simply destroy the American economy. You wouldn't need an attack by Al-Qaeda or anyone else. We would simply destroy ourselves, and that's exactly the direction I fear we're headed, unless we get to starting to build those nuclear power plants. And for those people who are so concerned about, what are you going to do with the spent fuel rods? You know, we don't want those going to our town. You know, they could explode at any time. Why, the wicked terrorists could get their hands on those spent fuel rods, grind them up and make a dirty bomb. And all of this goes on and on and on. Let me tell you, all the rest of the world is using nuclear power. They reprocess the spent nuclear fuel. You don't have to worry about storing it in Nevada. You don't have to worry about all these things about going underground, and back there's going to be there for years. You can actually, of course, reprocess the fuel rods and end up with almost no residual. They have suppressed this information from the American people for 30 years, and they've blocked effectively our implementation of the most economical and most safest, far safer than, say, coal being used. An awful lot of people die in coal mines. I'll tell you, there were far more people who died in the backseat of Ted Kennedy's car there in Chappaquiddick than have ever died from nuclear power plants. But they're not telling the American people that. That is part of the establishment's effort to discourage doing what we should do to make ourselves energy independent. Well, what are some of the other things that you think are important, Bill? Let me just put our telephone number out there. It's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question or comment for Mr. Bill Powers, who writes a newsletter, he's very well thought of, his information is accurate, so let's get some of your other thoughts, things you're concerned about.
One of the things that I'm closely tracking right now is what's going on in Venezuela. Venezuela is one of the top two or three exporters of oil and refined products to the United States, behind Canada and Mexico, and one of the things we're seeing there is they're having a recall election for President Hugo Chavez. It's never a dull moment when you talk about Venezuelan politics these days, and it's very difficult to tell whether they're going to, if they have a supply disruption, we will see $50 oil very, very soon, because right now, and especially we will see gasoline go through the roof. Venezuela owns the largest gasoline refinery in the Western Hemisphere. It's on St. Croix. It's a joint venture with Amaretta Hess. And this refinery, as well as their other refineries in Curacao and on the coast, in the Gulf Coast of Texas, these refineries are designed or have their settings so that they will take heavy Venezuelan crude, which it's not going to be easily replaced if crude oil coming out of Venezuela is cut off for any reason whatsoever, and that as these refineries have to shut down, the price of refined products, namely gasoline and to some degree heating oil, will just skyrocket. So that's a catalyst for much higher prices that has not gotten a lot of attention that I think will in the very near future.
Well, of course, what we read in the paper is that Chavez is a Marxist. He's very close to Fidel Castro. He's very close to the Marxist who controls Brazil. Of course, I never believe what I read in the paper. What's your take on what's going on down there? And what part is America playing? A lot of people say the CIA is doing everything they can to overthrow Chavez. In fact, some people are even talking about the possibility, if we can get things straight out in Iraq, of a direct invasion in Venezuela to secure the oil there. What are your thoughts?
Well, I don't see us getting too involved with Venezuela. I think it's a real difficult situation down there. I think Chavez is probably going to lose a referendum soon, sometime this year. I just think that it could end up in political chaos, but there's not a whole lot that can be done about it. I mean, Chavez is clearly a Marxist. They basically give about 50,000 barrels of oil a day to Cuba in return for very little payment. And that's been no secret, and this has been going on for a number of years. And I just really am convinced that they're on the verge of having a big slowdown in their oil production. I mean, one of the things that Chavez did after the oil strike last year was he fired about 18,500 members of the National Oil Company. So work there has very much slowed down, and a lot of the fields are not getting the maintenance that they need to continue production. So either production is going to fall rapidly from a political situation, or it'll just fall due to lack of attention to their very aging and complicated fields down there. So they're in a very difficult situation.
Well, of course, wasn't Chavez democratically elected? Didn't he get a majority of the vote there? Wasn't it an honest election?
Yes, it was. I mean, I really am not as far as he definitely has had a lot of support at one time. However, I think he has been very much pandering towards the lower income levels of Venezuelan society, and I think this has alienated the majority of the middle class and upper classes in Venezuelan society. So you have two very opposite political views that are going that are currently exist in the country, and it's a very polarized nation, and I just don't think there's it's going to be easy to make a lot of progress economically down there under the circumstances.
Well, of course, he claims that he is trying to fight the corruption that the ruling class has, that he says has been exploiting the poor for so many years. Is there any truth to that, or is he simply using this politics of envy?
Well, I think it's politics of envy, and I think there's. And Venezuela, for the most part, is a very poor country as far as per capita GDP goes. So the government seems to spend a lot of money on activities such as their really donation of oil to Cuba and other questionable activities. So there's plenty of blame to go around for. The lack of economic progress, and I think some of his policies have been he's devalued the bolivar, which is their national currency. He did that this year. because the country's finances are in such horrible shape. So he is he's causing some of the problems himself and some of the problems he inherited. So I think that unfortunately some of it's going to come to a head in this recall election, and it's going to be something that's going to keep the oil markets very nervous for at least the rest of this year.
And of course, your point is that if they have unrest there and cut off the oil supply, this could really push us up towards $50, if not $100 barrel oil here, and that would have a tremendous impact on our domestic economy.
Yes, correct. One of the things that's hard to understand is it's not so much high oil prices, but when you get into shortages of refined products, especially gasoline, that makes it very, very difficult to really gauge what the economic impact is going to be.
Well, one of the things that really bothers me is that they seem to be shutting down the refineries here in the United States instead of building them. So it seems that the refineries we have now are working at 100% capacity. We ought to be building other refineries, you know, so that we would have the, you know, if we need them, that they'd be available.
Yes, has not been a refinery built in this country in, I think, over 20 years. I think it might be closer to 25 years. Also, it's the same in Mexico. Mexico has not built a refinery in, I think, over 25 years.
But so, isn't a lot of this here in the United States, all the rules and regulations and permits and permits on permits and permits on permits on permits, that makes it almost impossible to do anything like this?
It does. One of the things that's very difficult is, as you mentioned, environmental permitting in the United States for a refinery. But the also view, until I think very, very recently, has been that there's really no need to do it since there's always plenty of supply elsewhere that we can import from either even European refineries, refineries in the Caribbean and South America. So there's always been the view that why do we want to have a refinery here when we could always get it elsewhere? So I think this attitude is changing in the sense that the supplies are very, very tight elsewhere in the world, and there's very little excess refining capacity. So I think there will be a change in people's attitudes, but it's going to take some time.
Well, I think that we should try to be as self-sufficient as possible. I think we're putting ourselves into a tremendously vulnerable position from the point of view of oil, having to get it from other countries. I'm talking about the refined products. Just as today, so many of the things that we need for our sophisticated military hardware, our intercontinental ballistic missiles and our military equipment, is being made over in communist China. What's wrong with this picture? We've actually shipped our industries that makes the sophisticated equipment to countries that talk about nuking Los Angeles. Certainly a disaster if we cut off oil supplies and we couldn't get them from other countries. It seems almost as if there's this desire for self-destruction here in America.
As far as military equipment, that's really that type of those things are a little outside of my realm of expertise, but one of the things we have definitely done is we've increased our imports of oil from overseas. This has really been a dramatic change, and as well as natural gas from Canada has gone up over, it went up for 16 straight years, from the mid 80s till 2003, and this is having a huge impact on the value of the U.S. dollar, and I think it's going to have an even bigger impact on the U.S. dollar as we have a structural trade deficit, and a lot of that's going to have to do with paying higher prices for imported energy.
And Chris, if with a $500 billion a year deficit, as the value of the dollar goes down, we're even going to have to pay higher prices. And I'm very, very concerned that, you know, there's never been any history, a nation that has ever spent itself into prosperity. And we have become the biggest debtor nation in the world, and at one time we were the biggest lending nation in the world, now we're the biggest debtor nation. I don't see how we can possibly survive the debt load, and now we're plunged into a war over there in the Middle East that's going to cost, you know, probably hundreds of billions of dollars a year, more or less indefinitely.
I mean, that's one of the things that is becoming, I think, more readily recognized is the depreciating value of the U.S. dollar. And also, I think that, you know, in dollar terms, oil has gone up substantially. The price of oil in euro terms has not appreciated nearly as much. It's very close to being flat over the last couple years.
But that is because the euro has gone, pardon me, the dollar has devalued almost 40% in relationship to the euro after the last several years, over the last several years. So their currency is stable, ours is unstable, and of course as the value of the euro goes down and prices go up, here, domestic prices, we wipe out the savings, the middle class, and eventually you wipe out the middle class.
To some degree, I believe that there's some truth to that. I think that middle-class savings, and one of the biggest things that I struggle with, that I see that's really misleading, is the continuing printing of dollars. And I think that that very few people understand that, and I think that it is the government has, by doing this, is undermining the faith in the currency and the faith in the government. And I think it's, you know, we do not have a sound currency right now due to the deficit spending, due to the trade deficit. And I think that that's a real tragedy, in my opinion. And I think having this corrected is going to be painful.
It really is. I'm very much afraid you're right. Well, we're just about out of time. What are the parting thoughts that you would like to leave for our listeners this evening?
I just think that one of the things that's very important to recognize is that oil prices and energy prices are not probably not returning to levels we've seen in previous years. They're probably going to stay at these levels, and most likely they will continue higher, so that I think everybody should adjust their lifestyles to account for higher energy prices. And this might be some painful choices, driving a more fuel-efficient car, living closer to work, having a more energy-efficient home. These are all important things, important steps that I think everybody should be taking to get ready for higher energy prices.
And of course, they've already doubled our electricity rates, almost doubled our electricity rates here in California. The price of natural gas has gone up, and now we find the gas going up at the gas pump, but the government assures us there's no inflation. Well, Bill, I really want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with us this evening. Let's once again get out your telephone number. Let's get out your website.
Yes, if listeners would like to reach me, I can. My website is www.canadianenergyviewpoint.com, or you can reach me via email at bill@canadianenergyviewpoint.com.
bill@canadianenergyviewpoint.com. All right, is there a telephone number in case people don't have a computer?
Yes, you can reach me at 773-271-7574.
Repeat that one more time, because on the radio you always have to repeat numbers at least twice, sometimes even three times.
Okay, it's 773-271-7574.
Well, our guest has been Bill Powers, and of course he's giving us an overview of the energy situation. He's very well thought of. He's a frequent guest on Jim Poplava's show, and we'll be having Jim as our guest next week. Thank you so very much for being with us. God bless you. Look forward to talking to you again.
It was great being here. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Well, this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and if we try to bring you all sorts of discussions on all sorts of issues from various points of view. So we'll, if you want to know what I think, you can always call in and ask, but we want you to know what Bill Powers thinks, because he studies this and studies it regularly. I will tell you that I believe we should have gone to nuclear energy a long time ago. I believe it has been intentionally blocked to bring us into a crisis situation. I believe that they're blocking the development of oil and natural gas in this country. They're running the price of electricity up because they really want to lower the living standards of the American people. For those of you who have not heard my interviews with Lindsay Williams, should hear them, and I, of course, check them out myself. Talk to one of the executives, one of the major oil companies in the world, and of course he confirmed what Lindsay had told me. There's more oil up off the North Slope at a place called Gull Island than they have in Saudi Arabia. We've got all that oil up there. It's been there going back to the mid-1970s, and of course they're specifically not tapping into it. They're creating artificial shortages. We could be easily energy independent. But, of course, what the real purpose is they want to lower our living standards, and I'm very, very concerned about what's going on. So if you'd like to get my interviews with Lindsay Williams, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And as they say, I specifically checked the story just to make sure it was accurate. And then we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, and you do that by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV. War. We have a wonderful new video. It's 4 hours long. It's called They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. It goes into the satanic, demonic influence within the music industry, and much of that music has actually got it into the Christian churches today in the name of the church growth movement, and we want, of course, make the church more like regular society so people can come in and they can come to the churches and hear the message and just feel completely at home. They can hear the same rock music there, and certainly not a convicting message at all, because we'd never want to convince anybody that they're sinners saved by grace. In fact, if you're not a sinner, you really don't need a savior, but you'll learn all about all sorts of little interesting things as you go to these churches. But the sound gospel, which is so vital to understanding what's going on, is progressively watered down in the process of creating church growth. If you need, I'd get our video on the church growth movement. It's called Diaprax in the Church. That's Diaprax in the Church. We have a 4-tape set. It's called The Church Growth Movement. You will want to get the video, or consider getting the video. They sold their souls for rock and roll. Now, one of the most shocking videos I've seen in a good while, and it goes into the background of Aleister Crowley, who was a Satanist, and his influence on modern music, on sex education, on Alfred Kinsey, on Harry Hay, who led the gay liberation movement, on Timothy Leary, who led the drug movement. And that's They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, 4-hour video. And then, of course, we have our 4-tape set on Aleister Crowley and his friends. And then we have our 4-tape set on the Skull and Bones. We have our 4-tape set on the Bohemian Grove, where our presidents and our financial leaders, government leaders go. And we, of course, in this 4-tape set, you're going to hear from a young woman who was sent there from the CIA to compromise the leaders of this country so that they would be under control as well. So you remember, they're all available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, give us a call. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival, because we're involved in a spiritual battle, and most people don't even know the battle is going on. For we struggle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spirits of wickedness in high places. Until tomorrow evening, please pray for Radio Liberty, and may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our colleagues, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls until the half hour. After that, we welcome your calls. Our special guest today is James Ninehouse, and we're going to be talking about his book, An Old Earth. Why not? James, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, Dr. Stan, it's great being with you.
All right, fine. Of course, we did a program, I guess, was just this morning on the same subject, but it's an important subject because we have children all across America going to government-controlled schools whose purpose is not to educate the children, because if that purpose was to educate them, we wouldn't have the low scores as far as reading and math and lack of comprehension that we do. We're among the lowest achievers in the entire world, and spending as much money as we do, you could not have accomplished what we have accomplished of dumbing down the American people unintentionally. But the purpose of our school system is not to educate, but to indoctrinate, and that is in a different religion. Now, the one thing they want to do is destroy the child's faith in Christianity, because Christianity was the foundation upon which our freedom rests. It was this idea that all men were created equal and endowed by the Creator with certain unalienable rights, and that governments were instituted among men to preserve those rights, that in America our freedom came from God, and the God they were talking about was the Jesus Christ of the Bible. Well, the purpose of education today is to indoctrinate our children in evolution, and the first thing they have to do is convince them that the earth has been here billions and billions and billions of years, and that mankind has been here billions and millions of years, and man evolved from the lower forms of life, and they have all of this is supposedly science and proven, and it's, I have to admit, at one time I believed all of these things because, well, that's what my teachers told me, and they wouldn't lie to me. Well, maybe they didn't know that they were lying, but the scientific foundation for most of what you have learned about the age of the earth and about evolution and creation, much of what you've learned about evolution is just not true. In fact, I would like to suggest that everything you've learned about evolution is not true, and so much of this centers around, has the earth really been here billions and billions and billions of years, as I was told when I went through college there in Berkeley back in the 1950s. Well, James, why don't you pick up the story from there, because you've spent a lot of time studying this, and your question, old earth, why not? And you tell us why not.
Yes, indeed. Yes, in that book I present 25 common claims made by Lyellian Darwinists, if you will, old earthers, the people you've been speaking of, have been indoctrinating us with this idea that goo has evolved into us over hundreds of millions of years, and the earth and universe have been here for billions of years. And it's just a shame. And you know, the animal kinds, for instance, we do believe, I just lost my train of thought, but I did want to mention this. We don't, Darwinian evolution does not happen. Now, sometimes creationists will become pigeonholed by mainstream scientists, because the mainstream scientists will say, well, you don't believe in evolution, therefore you're just a total, you know, you're irrational. You aren't faced up with reality of what the scientific, what science is saying. But creationists do believe in evolution, Dr. Stan, in the sense that we believe in variation within the respective animal kinds, the biblical animal kinds, as it were. For instance, of the cat kind, lions and tigers can mate and produce offspring. This proves that they came from common ancestors. This proves that lions and tigers came from a common ancestor. and tigers and leopards can breed and produce offspring, which proves that they, too, came from common ancestors. Therefore, possibly all of the cats, the, quote, species, end quote, of cats we have in the world, in reality are merely variants of the original two cats that were on Noah's Ark. Maybe there were four cats, maybe two of a smaller kind and two of a larger kind, perhaps some breakdown like that. Nevertheless, with that genetic truth, or that truth of genetics in mind, only 16,000 kinds of animals need have been on Noah's Ark. And that would have only taken up 20% of the volume of Noah's Ark. Therefore, to say that the Noah's Ark proposition is preposterous is to contradict obvious genetic science. You know, these many genuses and families in reality are not, or which are considered separate genuses or families, in reality are of the same animal kind. The cats, for instance, the dogs. Almost all the dogs can interbreed and produce offspring. That's coyotes, that's dingoes, that's wolves, that's poodles. They can all interbreed, you know, size not, you know, keeping them apart, as it were. They can, proving that they came from common ancestors. So maybe two or four of the dog kind on Noah's Ark. So this is evolution in the sense of natural selection within the animal kinds. But it is not Darwinian evolution, which has been forced down our throats, which, of course, is, for instance, the fish evolving into reptiles 200 million years ago. Well, that's preposterous, because a fish, what's a fish going to be when it's half fish and half reptile? It's crawling up on the land, it still has gills, or does it have lungs? Or does it have some intermediary breathing system?
Right.
The whole thing's preposterous. What was a reptile as it was evolving into a bird before its wings had fully evolved? It couldn't run and it couldn't fly. What did it do? Flop around on the ground for 10,000 generations waiting for a more fortuitous, quote-unquote, mutations?
Well, I think that the thing that we have to find is there really aren't any intermediaries between the various species. There's so the whole idea that the Piltdown Man was the missing link between man and ape, it was a fraud. It was a scientific fraud. And the same thing with the Nebraska Man that they brought up at the Scopes trial when Clarence Darrow and the very, very famous lawyer who was on our side actually debated the issue.
William Jennings Bryan.
William Jennings Bryan.
I'm sorry.
And, of course, they talked about the Nebraska Man. Why, that every scientist knew that that was the missing link. And they even had pictures of him. But it was really all based upon the finding of a tooth. A solitary tooth of a pig, and eventually they found the rest of the pig. But I hate to say this, but most of this, what the science calls science today, is fraudulent. I mean, you're not going to find any scientists coming out and say Kinsey is a fraud. If they did, they'd be chased out of the scientific community. I'm sure there are good people in the scientific community who try to do good work, but none of them have the courage to come up and say, look, evolution is a fraud. You know, the simplest solution is God created the heaven and the earth, because if they said that, they would be drummed out of the scientific club, they would lose their position at the university, and of course they would never get a job elsewhere again. That is what's known as a scientific examination. There is an academic freedom. There is no academic freedom in the universities today, and you come out with a position that says that evolution is a lie, and they will make your life just as miserable as they can. So there's very little tolerance there. Let's get into some of the things that you have found, James, that definitely suggest that this is a young Earth rather than an old Earth.
Sure. You know, the Earth's magnetic field is degrading. The Earth's magnetic field strength, rather, is degrading 7.5% every 150 years. We've had the technological capability to measure the magnetic field strength of the Earth over the last 150 years. We've measured it. It's decreased 7.5% in those 150 years. If you extrapolate that rate of our magnetic field strength decrease, you know, back into the past when it was stronger, Only 20,000 years ago, at that rate of decline, you know, extrapolating back in the past when it was higher, only 20,000 years ago, this heat generated from that projected Earth's magnetic field strength would have melted the Earth's crust. And that is only 20,000 years ago. At current erosional rates, all the continents should have leveled to sea level in under 15 million years, and yet many of the rocks in the continents are billions of years old. So obviously something is highly, highly amiss here. And let me add this. The future sedimentary rocks that we see up on the continents when you're driving through a road cut, Dr. Stan, you'll see the bands of different colored horizontal layers. Those are sedimentary rocks, sandstone shales and limestones that are laid down at the bottom of a body of water. That is what sedimentary means. Well, the future sedimentary rocks that will be up on the continents are allegedly being deposited today at the deltas of rivers. Now, how is the delta of a river going to get up on top of a mountaintop with billions of creatures entombed therein? And how is a delta, which averages 50 miles by 50 miles in aerial extent, say, how is that going to transform into a sedimentary layer that covers multiple states, like the Morrison Formation, which covers one half of the United States and grades into other layers, which proves that all these layers were laid down at the bottom of one body of water, which covered all the continents, entombing billions of creatures within these sedimentary layers. That was Noah's flood. And incidentally, the mountains rose at the close of the flood year, as proven by the lack of tension cracks in the folded sedimentary layers in the mountains, which tells us that these sedimentary layers were still wet and soft when the mountain uplift occurred. That is, shortly after Noah's flood, a flood that covered the entire earth, a flood that has known over 500 current-day tribes to this day. Anthropologists, archaeologists, adventurers will come upon a new tribe. One of the primary legends that almost all of them have is of a global catastrophe, with the god or gods becoming angry with mankind, deciding to destroy the earth by water. In all of the stories, why not by fire, Dr. Stan? Why not by a hyper hurricane? It's always by water. It's always a flood, often with eight people on board the vessel, a chest, a canoe, various floating mechanisms, which have been culturalized, obviously, through the centuries as these people had moved out into their disparate areas of the globe, migrating away from and dispersing away from Mesopotamia, where Babylon and the Indus Valley civilization and Egypt were the earliest civilizations formed, with high technological savvy. Boom, right off the bat, and allegedly straight out from caveman, they go to the architectural genius of Egypt. The whole thing is preposterous. But I cover all these topics, and including the evidences from astronomy that the Earth is truly only in the thousands of years of age, just like the Bible says, and just like many ancient cultures and tribes suggest in their legends. And my website, I have articles at my website, too, and you can learn more about my book. And listeners, you need to equip yourself with this information, because I guarantee you can intellectually get up in these people's faces and hold your own and win. And, you know, you can defeat them on all their points if you just have this information.
All right, and, James. Well, let's get some of the specific things. Now, you talk about the astrological evidence, and tell us a little bit about, pardon me, astronomy evidence. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the astronomy? Why is that important, and how does this have to do with asteroids and comets and things of that sort?
Yeah, well, the comets, you know, and we discussed on another show that comets and meteors in our solar system, the scientists have calculated that all of them should be gone in under 10,000 years, which tells us that the solar system is under 10,000 years of age, because all of them should either smacked into a planet or burned up because they went near a planet enough times, like the Halley's Comet, and progressively burned up within and under 10,000 years, or reached an escape velocity going near the edge of the gravitational field of the solar system with a high enough velocity as to escape the gravitational pull of the solar system. Scientists tell us that they all should have disappeared from our solar system in under 10,000 years. You know, the supernova remnants are of such, they're debris fields from supernova explosions. They're all of such a small diameter that they all must have blown up only thousands of years ago, the oldest ones. On and on and on, the neutrinos from the sun have emitted at such a low volume as is registered in cobalt mines, believe it or not, in cobalt deposits. These neutrinos from the sun are recorded, and the level of the emissions from the sun suggest and dictate that the sun be only in the thousands of years of age.
For our listeners who may not know what a neutrino is, would you like to explain what a neutrino is? Because this is something, I know when I went to college, we learned about electrons and neutrons and protons. We never heard of a neutrino. What is a neutrino, and why is that so significant?
Well, it's hydrogen degrading into helium, I believe, is the sequence.
Well, it's just a small energy particle that
nuclear fusion that
you'll find in the certainly in the nucleus of cells, and it's this very, very small energy particle, and a lot of those come out of the sun, don't they?
Right. It's a byproduct of the sun's burning up, if you will. It's nuclear fusion, I believe, as I recall, and it is a subatomic particle that's emitted. And the small emissions recorded in the cobalt deposits tell us that there's been a short term period of the sun's burning, of nuclear fusion in the sun. There should be many more neutrino emissions recorded in the cobalt deposits. But by orders of magnitude, far too few of these neutrino emissions recorded. And this is a real head-scratcher also for the astronomers. They just cannot explain that.
All right, and then the other thing is the relationship between the moon and the Earth. And certainly we know that the moon is moving away from the Earth. What's the rate of speed it's moving away from the Earth?
I'm not sure.
Okay, fine, but certainly if it was moving, even at a certain period of time, we were billions and billions of years old, why haven't they sort of calculated that, you know, if that were really true, that one time the moon had been right on the Earth's surface?
Right, yeah. How long ago was that? Would that have been?
Right. Well, they say that the Earth is billions of years old, and yet the moon is constantly moving away in a certain amount every year. And it's been calculated that if that were really true, that at one time the moon would have been laying right on the Earth's surface.
Right. Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, all the slow-spinning solid planets in the solar system, most of their meteor impacts or meteor craters are on one side of said planet, except Earth, of course. Why is that? Because the flood sediments from Noah's flood, after the planet exploded, apparently there's a void, a debris field from a planet that exploded, I believe, between Jupiter and Mercury in the rotation system there in the solar system. But anyway, ancient legends say that a meteor impact induced the global encompassing flood. And this would explain the lack of meteor craters on the surface of the Earth, because they were covered up by the flood sediments. But on the other solid, slow-spinning planets in the solar system, impact craters on one side of the slow-spinning solid planets, suggesting that they were blasted from one direction, which further corroborates this void in the solar system where, according to the debris fields and the impact craters on the meteor, this explosion may well have occurred about 4,400 years ago, which was just before Noah's flood. And several legends, a Chinese legend, of course the Chinese dispersed from Mesopotamia, and I believe an Inca legend, or no, it's from India, actually. In fact, the legend from India says that a bright star appeared in the sky, and an hour later it was as big as an elephant, and then the disaster hit and the global flood of Manu and the seven rishis. Hello, eight people, and Manu is Noah.
We're going to be back here in just a moment here, and we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, James Nienhaus, and we're talking about his book, Old Earth, Why Not? And, of course, how do you discuss this intelligently with somebody who honestly believes what they have learned in college, what they learned in high school, what they learned in grammar school, and that is, of course, that evolution is taught not as a scientific theory, but as a fact, and one of the most important things of the evolutionary theory is the fact that the Earth has been here billions and billions and billions of years. Now, how do we then address the issue that's raised, James, where they talk about, well, you know, we have these stars out there, and they're billions of light years away, and the light that we see from that star today was actually generated 2 billion years ago. It's 2 billion years in transit coming from that star to the United States. How do you address that issue?
Oh, yes. Well, during the creation week, as matter expanded out and coalesced into the stars and planets, gravitational time dilation was operant or was in operation because the matter expanded out and coalesced, similar to the way the Big Bang Theory is set up. But according to reality and the biblical account and the three-dimensional nature of this expansion of matter outwards, we had gravitational time dilation during the first few days of creation as the matter spread outwards. Therefore, as the distant stars were coalescing and the starlight was coming from them, they came from the stars at super accelerated speeds just during the first few days of creation. Therefore, those distant stars need not be billions of years old because of gravitational time dilation that I speak of, which is within the purview of Einstein's general theory of relativity. And this makes a mockery, this fact of gravitational time dilation, or the theoretical fact that this could, and I believe certainly did, occur, is that the Big Bang Theory encompasses the same idea of matter expanding outward from a beginning point, but the Big Bangers say that, well, there really is not an edge to this expanded out matter, which there obviously must be. If there's a beginning point and the matter expanded out in all directions, there must be an edge of that expanded matter. Well, the Big Bangers say, no, the matter in the universe is limitless. It goes on forever. Which is and because they have to say that, Dr. Stan, because if they admitted that there's an edge to this expanded matter from the Big Bang's beginning vortex, they would have to admit this possibility of gravitational time dilation.
Well, I think you're
during the
have
expansion,
to.
And therefore they would have to admit that those distant stars need not be billions of years old.
Well, I think you're going to have to explain for our listeners what this gravitational time dilation is, because it's a very interesting term. I have an idea what it's about, but for our listeners, I don't think they do. So would you like to sort of approach that phrase so that they can understand it?
Sure. Well, a clock at sea level ticks slower than a clock on top of Mount Everest. Why is that? It's because the clock at sea level is closer to the mass of the Earth. The gravitational pull from the mass of the Earth slows down time, if you will. It literally does to a very small degree. A clock at sea level ticks slower than a clock farther away from the gravitational mass up on top of the Himalaya Mountains.
But what happens if we have a digital watch that really would not be subject to that, that's run by a crystal? And we're gonna be back here in just a moment with our special guest, James Nienhaus. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, James Nienhaus, and we're talking about his book, Old Earth, Why Not? And he's been talking about this gravitational time concept, and of course he's mentioning that a clock will tick slower at ground level than it will at the top of a mountain. And I'm simply asking, and he feels this is because of the pull of gravity, but what about, you know, if you're just using something like a digital watch that really runs out of crystal?
Same principle. Everything slows down. You would age slower, you know, all things being equal, on top of Mount Everest. That's the fact of gravity. That's a fact of the gravitational pull effect. Therefore, during the creation week, as matter was expanded out, we had matter aging, developing, maturing, if you will, rapidly at the distant points of this debris expansion. And as more and more matter expanded out, an event horizon, which is the point beyond which the rapid aging and the speed of light and the maturation was occurring. And as more and more matter expanded out past this event horizon collapsed. So as more and more matter passed through it, the event horizon collapsed, and eventually went to nothing, maybe at day four or five of the creation. The concept is the reciprocal concept of the black hole. This is called a white hole scenario with matter expanding out. Well, with a black hole, as you approach the black hole, everything slows down. Aging slows down. Within these three, I think they've actually found three black holes. So the creation event is the opposite of a black hole effect. We have gravitational time dilation rather than slowing down as we approach the black hole.
All right, fine. So let's talk about the Big Bang Theory, because I think this is so important. You know, the scientists have to explain where it all came from. So, you know, they can't say that God created the heavens and the earth, so they have to come up with, well, it was the Big Bang. And where did life begin? Well, that came from outer space, because, of course, they really don't want to ask where life came in outer space, but they have to come up with a logical explanation rather than the very simple one that those of us who believe in the validity of the scriptures accept, and that is that God created it all. So, but what about the Big Bang, and why, you know, if the world is and the universe is billions and billions and billions of years old, why is this an invalid concept?
Why is what an invalid concept?
Why is the Big Bang, and because we would just be...
Well, for the reasons I just told you. They do not acknowledge that there's it's a bounded universe, which is necessitated by the Big Bang concept, which is a three-dimensional concept. You understand, as the matter expands out from a center point, expands out in all directions, by definition, there's an edge of that. But they won't admit that there's an edge of that, because if they did, they'd admit that gravitational time dilation comes into play. So they're lying to us. They're utilizing two mutually contradictory presuppositions. On one hand, they'll say, well, the universe, we do have an expanding universe with this Big Bang from a central point. Yes, but they won't tell you, which tells us that it is bounded. And then on the other hand, they'll say the universe is boundless. So they can't have it both ways, but they do, because they get away with it, because people don't call them to task for the reasons you cited, Dr. Stan, because it's a closed-mouth society, and they dominate the media, and we need to get informed, and we need to get in informal debates, public discussions, video conferences. We need to... Evolutionists, they won't debate us anymore. They haven't debated us for 3 years, any debates of note that I'm aware of. And they've been told not to come near creationists, particularly creationists that have the information. You know, because they don't want to debate. When you're way ahead in a race, Dr. Stan, why debate the one, the creationists, if you will, that are far behind? It doesn't make any sense. They're in the catbird seat. They have no need to debate us. So we need a grassroots movement of dissemination of this information, so in informal groupings we can persuade people. And, you know, my website, if I can mention that, is genesisveracity.com, and you can fortify yourself, get some information, and I challenge the skeptics to check out my website and read about my book. It's very compelling evidence that we rarely hear about, and it may open a lot of eyes.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment or two with our special guest. We will welcome your calls, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Give us a call. I think this is an important subject. You have to understand that this whole idea of evolution, it was designed for one purpose only, and that is to destroy faith in God and in the Holy Scriptures. We'll be back in just a moment and welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, James Nienhaus, his book is The Old Earth, Why Not? And, of course, there's a lot of reasons why not. Can you give us a couple of other examples of why people should discredit the idea that this is a very old Earth?
Well, all the people groups, or almost all the people groups' recollections, except the people groups who weren't influenced by the numerology and the concept of multiple pralayas, is the Indian term, or global catastrophes. All the civilizations of the world have the most recent, quote-unquote, global catastrophe, the global flood. But the ancient Hindus, they say, well, before the global flood, as I discussed previously, of Manu and the seven rishis, that's eight, riding out the global flood. But they, some of these civilizations, like the Incas, the big sun worshippers, they'll have multiple disasters before the global flood that all the traditions acknowledge. But the non-big sun worshipping tribes who had this numerological influence, which I've got a heavy thesis coming out about base six, you know, Dr. Monteith, base six numbers from ancient Sumeria and the 360 degrees of the mapping system and the pyramids of Giza and the Celtic cross as a measuring device to astronomically measure and construct these intricate maps of longitude. It all ties together. These sun worshippers, they had a heavy numerological deal, and they imagined previous global disasters to the most recent one, which all the tribes of the world, you know, over 500 documented today, say was a global flood. So this, the people groups of the world all have knowledge of this.
And hold that thought for just a minute here, please. Oh, go ahead. We've got another minute before they bring our other stations on. Go ahead, James.
Okay. All these people groups from around the world, the ancient Egyptians, the ancient Babylonians, spoke of this global flood. The first king after the flood of Babylon was Cush. You know, he was the grandson of Noah through Ham. Kish was a city in southern Egypt. Ethiopis, in legend, was the son of Cush, the name Ethiopia. Javan, a grandson of Noah, is listed as one of the early progenitors of the nation of Greece. I read this in a secular textbook from Dartmouth College. Javan in the Index, early progenitor of the Greek nation. On and on and on, these secular corroborations of that which is written in Genesis 10,
the origin of the nation. Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, James Nienhaus. We're talking about his book, The Old Earth, Why Not? And I think it's important that we understand we have to be able to discuss these things. Now, the Bible says that God created the heavens and the earth, and of course, he created the animals according to their kind. Now, if that indeed is true, that explains where everything came from. But people say that's a simplistic situation. Well, of course, what's their alternative? Their alternative is evolution. It all started with a very, very simple form of life, and then gradually, over hundreds of millions of years, evolved into more complex life. The problem is now we go into the backgrounds of the genetics of individuals, and actually we have some of the same genes that animals have and that other forms of life have. There's a perfect order to everything. Things don't happen by accident. There is a perfect order. Somebody had to build the chromosomes and place the genes in place, and if somebody built them, there has to be a creator, and if there's a creator, then there has to be a God. And so the scientists are having real problems with all of their theories, and they come up with a Big Bang, and then they find out that there's a lot of holes in the Big Bang. And they come up with a Piltdown man, and they find it's a fraud. And they come up with a Nebraska man, and they find it's a fraud. And they come up with Lucy, and they find she was a chimpanzee or some
That's
similar
right.
thing.
She was a chimpanzee.
And so, you know, but the last thing that they can admit is that we're right and they're wrong, because they do not want to acknowledge there is a God, because if there is a God, then they're going to have to be beholden to him rather than to themselves. And the problem we have with so many of the people deeply involved in silence in science is that they look to themselves for answers rather than look to the God who created the heavens and the earth. So pick up the story from there, James, and let me once again give out our telephone number. If you have a question, a comment, you agree or you disagree, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Go ahead, James.
Sure. Yeah, I was speaking of the earliest, highly advanced megalithic societies there in the Middle East, the Indus civilization, the Babylonian civilization there in current-day Iraq, and Egypt. They all spoke of this global flood, with eight people riding out this global flood. And on top of that, in further corroboration of the Genesis account, they speak of 10 kings, or 10 shining ones, or 10 Apkallu, they are called, in the case of pre-flood Babylonian kings. These are 10 kings or dynasties before the global encompassing flood, going back to creation. You know, these pagan corroborations, they cannot get away with it, get away from it. It's in their ancient legends, and over 500 tribes from around the globe, all with a global flood legend, not with a global fire legend, not with a global hurricane legend, not with a global snowstorm legend. And speaking of the snowstorms and the ice age, you know, I'm maintaining that according to the Genesis model and according to the scientific evidence, the flood did occur around 4,400 years ago, and the anthropological evidence also. Oh, I hear one of your listeners thinking right now, well, Manetho's Egyptians king list goes back to 3000 BC. How can you say the flood was at 2400 BC, Mr. Nienhuis? Well, because Manetho's list, Manetho was an Egyptian priest from 300 BC. He compiled the King's List dynasties, which today is treated as holy writ by the secular anthropologists and archaeologists. And it says that the King's dynasties go back to just before, like 3100 BC. Which would be 700 years before I say the proposed flood date is. But as many critics of the Manetho list have noted, Manetho mentioned kings who in reality ruled simultaneously in different portions of Egypt at the same time. They ruled at the same time in different geographic locations. They were written up in sequential order. Mere viceroys or regents were written up in this list, documented to not have been kings, were also written up in this list. So for these reasons, you need to shorten that Egyptian's kings list, and when you properly shorten it, it comes right into form, right at 2400 BC for the beginning of the king's dynasties, of the post-flood dynasties of Egypt. You can say the same thing about the Babylonian kings list. They supposedly go back to 3000 BC, which is about 600 years too early according to the Genesis time frame. But those lists also are included in sequential order kings when in reality some of those kings ruled simultaneously in different geographical areas of the Babylonian region. So you can shorten that list also. That comes right into form at 2400 BC for the beginning of the Sumerian and the Akkadian and shortly thereafter the Babylonian Empire. So all the secular histories, or most of them, line up with this as well. Now, as I spoke earlier, the sun-worshipping great map-makers and sailors, the early Egyptians, the early Phoenicians, they had pralayas or disasters before the global encompassing flood, which are creations of their own mind, creations of their desire to defy the word of God. You know, I guarantee you there were characters, Noah's children, Noah's grandchildren, that wanted to mess up the word of God, just like they want to mess, you know, many people want to mess up the word of God today. So they were distorting what Noah was telling everybody. Some of his children and grandchildren went off, you know, with their own crazy ideas based upon this sun worship. They got carried away with their knowledge, their engineering knowledge, and they figured out the astronomical movements, and they said, well, prelayas or disasters like Noah's flood happened also before Noah's flood, because every time the stars would align such way after 43,200 years, say, for instance, another disaster would hit. That was all a figment of their imagination, based upon their pride that they had in their numerical and mathematical and astronomical abilities. But I cover this in my book, the geological evidences that confirm Noah's flood, the biology that confirms that all the animal kinds derived through natural selection within the animal kinds, not Darwinian evolution, in my book, Old Earth, Why Not? And my website, please, is www.genesisveracity.com. Genesisveracity.com. And pick up this information. I have some good articles too at the website.
All right, fine. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Now, there are many, many people who talk about the dust on the moon, and I know that you don't think that that is a valid point. The background of this was that there were many of the scientists working for NASA who felt that when we sent our landing craft to the moon, that since the moon was billions and billions and billions of years old, simply from solar dust, why the dust would be a fairly a high level. That's why they put their very long legs on the landing craft, was so that it could sink down into the dust there, wouldn't get completely covered over by it. At least this is what I've been told. And then when they got there, the dust was very, very thin. Now, why is that not a valid point, suggesting that it's a young moon rather than an old moon?
Well, I'll tell you the truth, I've kind of forgotten about it. I read four or five sources. I forget the exact reason why it's not a good argument, but I've read four or five leading creationists say, just kind of forget about that one. So,
all right.
I'm not really up on that one.
Well, I sort of like that one myself, but maybe there's some people out there who would know why that's not a good argument. But certainly, if we are billions of years old and the moon sitting there and it has dust on it, it ought to be pretty deep by now. But of course, it is not very deep at all. It's even, I remember the pictures you saw, and it was maybe an inch, half an inch, inch or so of dust there. So anyway, of course, there are many things that point to this being a much younger Earth. How do you address the issue of oil? We're told, oh, it took hundreds of millions and millions and millions of years to create the oil, and hundreds of millions and millions and millions of years to create the coal. And so this cannot be a young Earth because it took hundreds of millions of years to make the oil and the coal. How do you address that that statement?
Well, we've made coal and oil in the laboratories in a matter of weeks. So that kind of blows that all up, just putting some chemicals together, everyday chemicals, carbon materials. In the case of, yes, plant material, we made coal in the laboratory. Temperature and pressure and some plant material made coal in a couple weeks. From industrial sewage, we made oil in the laboratory. Not we, but they, an Australian outfit, made oil in the laboratory in a matter of weeks. So millions and millions of years are not required to form coal and oil. That is preposterous. And, you're mentioning these coal seams, or these coal layers, are huge also. You know, they often cover multiple states. Some of the coal fields, cover a third of the United States back east, and there's some large coal deposits also in aerial extent out west as well. And these coal deposits were supposedly formed at the bottom of swamps. They're supposedly ancient swamps. Well, at the base of these coal deposits, there are no roots. There are no ancient soils. There are no indications just below the coal deposits that was a swamp that was growing there. All the material within these coal seams were transported from a distance away. And we know this for, among other reasons, because within these coal deposits are trunks of trees that have been broken off at the roots. So they were transported in a watery mire, in a watery mud flow, along with other vegetative material. They were deposited with root systems broken off, all clean, all debris laid on top of, say, a sand layer previously deposited during Noah's flood. Here comes a vast mat of vegetative material with no linkage at all to the underlying material, proving that it was transported from a different location. Subsequently got covered by sand, clay, entombing creatures, entombing, the clams, the snails. And as a point of fact, speaking of the fossil record and all these creatures that were entombed during the flood, 99% of the creatures that are entombed within the flood-caused sedimentary layers from Noah's flood are marine creatures. Almost all the creatures, over 99%, are of marine creatures. And the percentage that are mammals is like 0.01%. So obviously it was a watery catastrophe, and most of the terrestrial animals fled uphill, avoided the floodwaters for a time, and then they swam for a while, they drowned, and then they floated, they bloated, they rotted, they decayed, and then there was nothing left to be fossilized. But the more dense bottom creatures, marine creatures that were in the pre-flood ocean environment, they readily succumbed, if that's a word, they succumbed to, more readily, to this disaster, this watery disaster that is reflected in these vast sedimentary layers that we see up on the continents with billions of creatures entombed therein. And the mountains rose, as I said previously, at the close of this global watery catastrophe, as proven by the lack of tension cracks in the folded sedimentary layers in the mountains, which tells us that those layers were still wet and soft, which tells us that they were, that the mountains uplifted shortly after those sedimentary layers had been laid down at the bottom of Noah's flood water. And incidentally, the water for Noah's flood came from the Bible speaks of the fountains of the deep. Well, the fountains of the deep were the mid-oceanic ridges that we see running through the oceanic crust when you look at the globe of the earth, like a seam on a baseball. Well, those are zones of oceanic crust slow separation today, but during the flood year they rapidly separated, and water and magma belched forth from the bowels of the earth, and 80% of magma that comes from the earth today is water, it's vapor water. So that was the source for the fountains of the deep. The Pangaea, the original supercontinent, separated. North and South America moved rapidly away from Europe and Africa. You slide those bodies of land back together in your imagination. They fit very nicely like a jigsaw puzzle. That was Pangaea, the supercontinent, pre-flood. It rapidly separated as the mid-oceanic ridge down the middle of the Atlantic Ocean belched water and magma, the fountains of the deep during Noah's flood year, the major source for the water. And a massive erosion up on the continents. A wave action during the flood water, of course, generally would go from the deep water and push the sediments back up onto the continents. Waves go from deep water generally to shallower water. That's how we see most of the sediments up on the continents. There's a paucity of a sedimentary material in the oceanic basins. In fact, at current erosional rates, all the oceanic basins should have filled with sediment within 80 million years, and the oceans are supposedly a billion years old. Well, they should have filled with sediment in under 80 million years at current erosional rates. So as you can see, there's a panoply of evidences from all kinds of tangential yet related at the same time fields that all dovetail, and it leads right back to the Genesis account. It's truly remarkable.
Well, now, what about the significance of the fact that sometimes you will find evidence of civilizations underwater? Now, what is the significance of that? I mean, sometimes you'll find pillars or monoliths, down 100 feet.
Sun worshippers.
What does that suggest?
That tells us that, well, the sea level rose a couple hundred feet when the Ice Age melted. And common knowledge or mainstream science will tell us, not common knowledge, common in a low sense, they say that the Ice Age ended at 10,000 BC, but these megaliths on the ocean floor today, which were covered when sea level rose, when the Ice Age ended, they were covered, are of architectural and religious motifs of, say, 2000 BC. they were built around 2000 BC. They are motifs from around 2000 BC. And yet, the old earthers say that the Ice Age ended at 10,000 BC. Well, this cannot be. For the Ice Age to have melted at 10,000 BC, the megaliths that were covered up by the melting of the Ice Age must be older than 10,000 BC. But this is a catch-22 from them, because they say there were no advanced civilizations until 3000 BC. But they can't have it both ways. Do you want 3000 BC for the first megalith, or at before 10,000 BC, which is necessitated by your saying that the Ice Age melted near 10,000 BC? In reality, however, Dr. Stan, the flood occurred about 2400 BC. The Ice Age lasted for about 800 years after the flood, up until about 1500 BC. These megaliths, which are now on the seafloor, were built during those 800 years from 2300 BC to 1500 BC. Then at 1500 BC, when the Ice Age melted, the sea level rose and covered those megaliths, which all archaeologists will tell you are truly a motif from around 2000 BC. So once again, the evidence confirms the Genesis account, and the 10,000 BC for the melting of the Ice Age, which is proposed by mainstream scientists, looks foolish in light of this and other evidences.
Well, I think that the one thing we can certainly say with a certain degree of confidence is the fact that there had to be a cataclysmic event, first of all, to create the levels of stratified fossils. In other words, something had to lay them down. There had to be
acute layers, Dr. Stan.
Right.
Fast.
And then, of course, there had to be a cataclysmic event to bury the organic material that certainly led to the formation of the coal, and sometimes it's fairly close to the surface and sometimes it's very deep. And then there had to be a cataclysmic event that would cover over the oil in many parts of the world. So I don't think there's any question there's a cataclysmic event, and certainly I don't think that the people who deny the Great Flood, have any explanation for that. They just say, well, they're there, this shows evolution. Doesn't show evolution at all. I think it was Ken Ham who has that definition of fossils. Billions of dead things lay down in sediment, covered over by water all over the world. And I think that's the cleverest statement. It's something you can imagine, you can see. Billions of dead things laid down in sediment, covered over with water all over the world. His definition of the fossil record, there was a cataclysmic event that laid them in sediment, covered them with water, and the waters may have receded, but now we see them in their stratified position. Well, we're just about out of time, James. Do you have a parting thought for our listeners?
Yes, just equip yourself, face-to-face, discussions with your friends. Become informed. You can be a world changer. You can be persuasive. You can have impact in your community if you're informed. You must have this information, and once you have this information, you can knock them out. You can knock them out with some good, solid science and anthropological knowledge that most people have not heard of, and they need to hear about it. So please check out my website, GenesisVeracity.com.
And somebody just called, wants to know where to get your book.
Yes, at GenesisVeracity.com.
All right,
Veracity is spelled V-E-R-A-C-I-T-Y.
And, of course, if they don't have a computer, how can they get your book?
They can give me a ring, and I'll take their information. My phone number is 713-784-6618.
All right, one more time.
Oh, yeah, 713-784-6618.
All right, fine. Well, thank you so very much, James. It's been a fascinating time. Parting thought for our listeners. We've got about 30 seconds.
Okay.
Well, that's all right. Go ahead.
Yeah, Darwinian evolution creationists do not believe in. We do believe in evolution. So don't let Darwinists say, well, creationists don't believe in evolution. Tell them, no, creationists don't believe in Darwinian evolution.
All right, fine. Thank you so much, and God bless you. We'll talk to you again. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when we have to remind you that our ministry is primarily listener-supported. And, of course, we look to you for your help if you believe that we are truly involved in a spiritual battle for the survival of Western civilization, and that the other side controls the media, controls the major universities, has an agenda, and part of that agenda is destroying the faith of our children in the God from which all blessings come. They've targeted the youth because they know they can't convince us older folks, that they're right. But if they can have the mind of the youth, that's what public education has always been about, is about controlling the youth. Now, we have some wonderful four-tape sets on outcome-based education, but the one I would suggest is so important for you is the one on Fed Ed. That's Fed Ed, and there's a book that goes with that. It's called, of all things, Fed Ed. And it will give you the background of the No Child Left Behind program, which is truly diabolical. It's based upon the concept not of educating our children, not leaving any child behind, as far as their values, their beliefs, and, of course, their attitudes. And the whole purpose of the No Child Left Behind is not to educate our children in reading and writing and arithmetic. It is change their values, attitudes, and belief. Prepare them for the New World Order, to indoctrinate them in this new educational system or this new religion, which is called environmentalism. And it is to convince them that the environment is in danger, and of course the solution is to embrace the New World Order, to reject traditional American beliefs, and certainly to reject the God of the Bible, from whom our freedom in America comes. America was different than other nations because our freedom came from God. And that's really what they want to do. That's what education's about. And if you have your children in government schools, if there's any way you can get them out, do it. Otherwise, get information on creation. And we carry a wonderful book. It's called Tornado in a Junkyard by James Perloff. That's Tornado in a Junkyard by James Perloff. And we have another one, I think it's called The Cruncher. It's very inexpensive. It has the answers to all the questions put forward by the people who are pushing Darwinian evolution. So we hope many of you will want to get this information. And if you'd like to know more about our ministry, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Of course, we hope that many of you will go to our website. That's radioliberty.com, where you can look at all of the items that we have. You can pull down our newsletters, which contains a great deal of information, and that you'll listen to our programs and our archives. We do 5 hours of live radio every day, starting at 7 in the morning and ending at 10 o'clock at night. But what a unique opportunity to reach out across America with the truth about this battle for the hearts and minds of our children. So we hope, if you would like to know more about Radio Liberty, that you'll certainly go to our website, that you'll listen to our programs, that you'll pull down our newsletters, that you'll copy those newsletters, and that you'll distribute those newsletters to others, that you'll tell other people about our ministry and about our programs, and encourage them to listen as well. And if you'd like to, of course, get a free copy of our newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, because if American people don't turn back to God, God will never again bless this nation. And then we ask you to pray for our leaders and ministers. But please don't forget to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, because we're on the front lines of this battle 24 hours a day, it seems. Well, anyway, until tomorrow evening, when we're going to have Alan Quist talking on education, we'll have Lindsay Williams talking about the syndrome of control. That should be a great program. Until tomorrow evening at the same time, Dr. Stan, goodbye. May the Lord be with you.